don't starve yourself. Jack replied with an image, a drake's eye view of what appeared to be a shimmering, shifting cloud that Clay soon realized was a large shoal of fish. Jack, it appeared, would not be going hungry in his absence. The Superior's steam whistle let out the four short blasts that indicated an imminent stop. Clay, feeling the faint, rhythmic thud of the auxiliary engine fade from the deck boards. It seemed Captain Heilmore had decided this was as far as the ship could go. "It's time," he told Jack. "If I die," he began, provoking an upsurge of fear in the Drake. Clay asserted his will, forcing his thoughts through the fog of distress. "If I die, you'll feel it. What you do then is up to you. Like I said, it's an awful big ocean."
The Lady Melinda.
Lauriabeth read the name Chief Bosware had painted on the steam launch's hull in finely executed letters of red and black.
"Couldn't we call her something a sight more fierce?"
"It's my former wife's name," the chief responded, rubbing his back as he straightened from tightening a bolt on the engine.
He vaulted over the craft's side onto the Superior's deck.
"And be assured, miss, she was plenty fierce enough, even after the divorce."
The engineer turned to Heilmore and touched two fingers to his forehead in a sketchy salute. Clay had noticed that the chief was perhaps the only crew member Heilmore afforded such leeway when it came to formal discipline.
"She's as ready as I can make her, sir."
"Fine work, chief," the captain told him. "All right, Mr. Talmont. Let's get her in the water, if you please."
"Aye, sir."
Under the young officer's guidance, a dozen crewmen lowered the Lady Melinda over the side and onto the swift-flowing surface of the Quillam. Skaggerhill climbed down first, followed by Chris, the only two in their party who had a notion of how to operate the engine. It was a coal burner and took a good half hour to heat the boiler to the required temperature. Supplies were duly lowered, enough for at least a month's travel, though Clay knew well they might have to resort to hunting for food in time.
"All I can spare," Heilmore said, handing Clay a satchel containing several flasks. 10 of green, 1 each of the other colors."
"Sure you can spare this much red?" Clay asked, checking the satchel.
"The exigencies of the mission require it, Mr. Torcreek."
Heilmore glanced down at the launch where the rest of the party waited. Uncle Braddon had taken up position on the prow and sat in now customary silence, his rifle cradled in his lap as his gaze roamed the river with predatory keenness.
"No regrets about your choices?" the captain asked.
"It's not too late. Mr. Steelfine would make a fine addition to this company, and I know he would relish the challenge."
"Yeah, but he also hates my guts."
Clay offered his hand and Heilmore took it.
"Captain O'Canis will be expecting regular communication," he said,
"as will I."
"Every 3 days till we get to the lake," Clay said. "After that, we'll reschedule as needed, depending on how the blue holds out."
He cast his gaze towards the stern of the ship, where Jack's spines could be seen tracking back and forth across the river. "If he leaves and don't come back within 2 days, it most likely means I'm dead. Same if Captain O'Canis don't hear from me or Lieutenant Sigerold for 5 days. In that case, it'd be best if you took off. Make for Verestia, like Miss Lethbridge said."
"Noted," Heilmore inclined his head. "But I thank you to leave command decisions to me."
"Of course."
Clay moved to the rail and clambered over, descending the rope net to the Lady Melinda. Chris was tending the engine, whilst Skaggerhill had the tiller. Lauriabeth and Sigerol were seated in the middle, whilst Preacher sat close to Braddon at the prow. Clay waited for his uncle to say something, hoping he would turn and offer at least some word of command to set them on their way. Even the smallest grunt would have been welcome. But he said nothing, continuing to sit and maintain his hungry vigil over the water. Clay opened his mouth to call to Braddon, but stopped when Lauriabeth caught his eye
and gave a stern shake of her head. "Daylight's burning," he said instead, lowering his gaze to Chris. "If she's ready, let's be on our way. Laurie, Lieutenant, eyes on the water. Preacher, watch the sky. It's a safe bet we'll have company before long."
Chapter 13. Lizanne.
10 million in syndicate scrip, eh? The broken-nosed man grinned at Lizanne as he lowered Trumaine's letter. Quite the offer, don't you think, Mother?
He held the letter out to the prim, neatly attired woman who stood close by.
Have a gander at the signature. I think you'll find it amusing.
The woman's handsome features remained impassive as she scanned the letter, though her lips curled a little when she got to the end.
"Your faithful correspondent, Captain Wolfcott Trumaine," she read, before raising her eyebrows at Lizanne. "Or Captain Noose, as he's known in these waters. I must confess, Miss Lethbridge, but for the manner of your arrival, I might otherwise have taken this as a rather poor joke."
"I have no jokes to offer you," Lizanne replied. "Just an honest offer in return for safe harbor and sound intelligence I believe you will find useful."
"Your captain hung my cousin on the deck of his own ship," the broken-nosed man said, then frowned and added, "Well, second cousin, and a truly rotten bastard to be sure, but still blood of my blood. And my people are all about blood. But then so are you. After all, it's your name, isn't it? Miss Blood."
Lizanne and Takela had been guided to a grand room on the second floor of the building the Varestians referred to simply as the Navigation. A title apparently derived from the building's original use as the home of the Loyal Guild of South Corventine Cartographers and Navigational Experts. The mapmakers and compass designers had long since been exiled back to their northern homelands, but the building remained, complete with its appropriate and overwhelming decor. Maps were everywhere, hanging in tapestry form on the walls, rendered in oils on huge canvases, reproduced as floor mosaics and even plasterwork reliefs on the ceilings. She assumed this particular chamber had been some kind of ballroom, the floor covered from end to end in a vast map of the world, which, judging from the florid Eutherian lettering and place names, dated back to the early corporate era. Apart from herself and Takela, the only other occupants were the broken-nosed man, his handsome of face if somewhat severe of demeanor mother, and a man of South Mandanorian origin, clad in curiously archaic clothing. Lizanne had quickly judged this man to be the most salient physical threat, not least by virtue of his cutlass and pistol, but also his muscular frame and set features, tensed as if in constant expectation of combat. She also deduced from the way the broken-nosed man moved about the room that he was not to be underestimated either.
"We know who you are, you see," he went on. "Famed defender of Carvenport. Hero of the Corventine Revolution, and, most importantly at this particular juncture, a thieving, murdering bitch in the employ of the Iron Ship Exceptional Initiatives Division."
All humor faded from his face, voice dropping to a murmur.
"And therefore not to be trusted."
"I know of you too,"
Lizanne replied, meeting his gaze squarely.
"Arshav Okanus, renowned pirate and former chief director of the criminal enclave known as the Hive, where I believe you lost a duel to an islander named Steelfine not so long ago. How's your nose, by the way?"
She turned her gaze from his reddening face before he could reply, inclining her head at the primly attired woman.
"And you are Ethilda Okanus, widow to the late founder of the Hive, and, I'm told, possessed of a more rational mind than your son. Be assured that we speak with one mind on matters of business,"
Ethilda replied. She briefly read through Tremaine's letter once more, before tossing it onto a nearby table.
This is worthless. With the Razzia lost, your syndicate's collapse is inevitable, along with much of the corporate world. What use will we have for your script then? It has always been nothing more than paper, after all, and we have sufficient kindling.
Lizanne took a moment to scan the opulence of the room, hoping the myriad maps might spark some stratagem.
I had hoped to address the whole council, she said,
playing for time as inspiration failed to materialize.
I believe a quorum of 8 is required before any decision can be reached.
She saw Arshav exchange an amused glance with his mother. I'm afraid you'll have to be content with a quorum of 2, he said. You see, upon return to our beloved homeland, there was what I believe historians refer to as a vicious power struggle. Our wise ruling council had taken it upon themselves to declare us dead after the Corventine attack on the Hive, helping themselves to our family holdings in the process. It took 5 successive duels to put the matter right, by which time the council was short 5 members and the remainder had decided they preferred life at sea.
So you see, Miss Blood, Athilda said, any accommodation you wish to make will require our agreement, and as yet I find myself content to let your fleet of beggars rot where it sits.
Lizanne looked down, biting on a frustrated sigh. She saw that her boot rested on the barrier isles, north of the Eratian continent, the toe covering the strait, the portal through which so much wealth had once flowed, enough to transform an entire world.
You're right, she said, raising her gaze to address Athilda. Without product, the corporate world will fall. But what are you without the corporations? With whom will you trade when they're gone? Whose ships will you prey upon? The Corventine Empire destroyed itself, trying to maintain the illusion it could remain separate, eternal and unchanged for all time. They failed to see a basic truth. The corporate world is the world. If it falls, so does everything else.
She lowered her gaze once more, striding across the map until her boots came to rest on Verestia.
Do you imagine you are immune here? I'm sure your spies have informed you of what befell the barrier isles in Theros.
We have defenses, Arshav said. A great many ships and the best sailors in the world.
The Corventines had the most modern fleet in the world, Lizanne returned. I watched it sink and burn off Carvenport. If you know as much as you claim, you'll have some inkling of the force that will come against you. An army of spoiled controlled by a single mind. And drakes, thousands of reds, greens and blues, all of them filled with hate and hunger by the thing that commands them.
Athilda exchanged another glance with her son, this one much more serious.
How will taking in a bunch of impoverished corporatists aid us? Arshav asked. It strikes me you will be more of a burden than a blessing.
Lizanne pointed at the mini growler. She had been obliged to surrender it on entering the room, and it lay on a table close to the entrance.
That, she said, and many more like it, along with larger and even more powerful weapons. You also saw the craft that brought us here. Give us the means and we can make more.
Arshav went to the mini growler, lifting it and pursing his lips in reluctant admiration.
A nice toy, he said, but expensive and time-consuming to manufacture, I would imagine.
There is something else, Lizanne told him. Something that can be fashioned in hours rather than days. I assume your men searched the aerostat. They would have found a carbine there.
Arshav raised an eyebrow at the man in the archaic clothing, who nodded.
Bring it here, please, Mr. Lockbar, the pirate told him.
I'll need a target, Lizanne said, reaching for the smoker
when Lockbar returned with it a few minutes later.
Something you don't value.
I think not, miss, Arshav said, taking the carbine from Lockbar
I'd rather form my own conclusions.
He went to one of the expansive window doors lining the room's south-facing wall and opened it. Stepping out onto the veranda beyond, he gestured for Lizanne to follow and pointed at something in the lush gardens below. A tall rectangular plinth sitting amidst a circle of flower beds.
The monument to the fallen members of the Corventine Navigational Guild, he said. Kept intact due to the sentiment of my predecessors. Personally, I see no reason to honor the souls of those who once enslaved us.
He put the carbine to his shoulder, chambered around, and fired.
King of the Deep,
he breathed as the top of the monument shattered.
Arshav laughed, worked the lever and fired again, blasting away another chunk of the plinth.
He kept on until the carbine was empty, his laughter increasing as he reduced the monument to a jagged remnant.
After due consideration, he said, lowering the smoker and coughing a little as he wafted the smoke away. I believe
further consideration is warranted.
Athilda broke in, giving her son a glare of sufficient severity as to wipe the laughter from his face. Athilda turned to Lizanne with a humorless smile.
In the meantime, you and your lovely young companion will be our guests. Mr. Lockbar, please see these ladies to their room.
Mr. Lockbar, together with a squad of five equally stern-faced guards, had escorted Lizanne and Takela to a room on the upper floor of the navigation. It was small with a narrow cot and a tiny window that had been nailed shut.
Servants' quarters, Takela sniffed with snobbish disdain. I doubt we'll be here long, Lizanne said, sitting on the cot.
Mr. Lockbar had relieved her of the vials of product in the spider, but she had had the foresight to conceal a vial of blue in her hollow boot heel. She had been permitted to keep her watch, and waited the required 43 minutes before commencing the trance at the scheduled hour.
Listen at the door, she told Takela, slotting the vial into the spider. If they come back, try to delay letting them in until I'm done.
She found Sophia Griffin wandering her mindscape in a black morning dress, her vibrant red hair the only color to be found. Lizanne thought the woman's mindscape must have been beautiful before her grief. She imagined dappled forest glades carpeted with wild flowers, above which butterflies danced in air scented by honeysuckle. Something almost certainly taken from a picture book read in childhood. Now it was like walking through the same scene reimagined by an illustrator in the midst of a depression. The forest was bleached of all color, the sky above the treetops an ominous smear of black and gray.
Another ship took off on its own yesterday,
Sophia informed Lizanne, her thoughts as dull and uncolored as the environment.
The second in 2 days.
Tell Captain Trumaine to do all he can to prevent further desertions, Lizanne told her.
I have a sense we will need to muster as large a workforce as possible, if our hosts choose to accept us, that is.
She paused, watching as Sophia gazed at something nearby. At first glance, Lizanne took it for a butterfly frozen in flight, but closer inspection revealed it to be a miniature person, a lissome young girl with diaphanous wings, plucking a morsel of pollen from an orchid.
The Sylph folk would visit me when I was a little girl, Sophia recalled. Whirling spirals around my head as I danced. Such music they sang. Nanny said it was all in my head and spanked me for my foolishness. And in time they went away. But I never truly stopped believing. Their music was so beautiful, far beyond the mind of a child to conjure.
Speaking of music, Lizanne interrupted, keen to break the woman's reverie, which she suspected might go on for some time. Has Macario made any more progress?
With your mysterious box? Not as far as I'm aware. He plays for me sometimes, when I get sad enough to start crying again. He's very kind.
Yes, he is. And you're... Lizanne fumbled for the right words.
Her experience of pregnant women was minimal, and she had determined long ago to avoid such a mammoth complication to her own life. Condition, she decided finally.
I am vomiting less thanks to Dr. Waygrand. He tells me it's far too soon for such things, but I feel my son kicking sometimes. Curiously, it only happens when I think of Zacchaeus. I believe he's keen to be born so he can avenge his father.
Lizanne clamped down on her own thoughts, lest the words, mad as a blue-addled rat, leach into the shared mindscape.
We'll have to ensure that won't be necessary, she told Sophia. Have you had any success in contacting Northern Fleet headquarters? Yes. My contact there was clearly very harassed, and seemed to regard my intelligence as more of a nuisance than anything. They had little to say, other than that Captain Trumaine is instructed to await further orders. I'm to trance again in 5 days. Ask Professor Lethbridge and Mr. Ptolemine to provide you with blueprints for their weapons designs and memorize them. When you trance with the Northern Fleet again, make it very clear that their best course of action is to build as many of these devices as they can.
I had the impression no one is building anything at the moment. Apparently a third of iron ship manufactories are on strike. There's a great deal of voter agitation in many cities, and the Protectorate is fully engaged in dealing with what my contact called urban disturbances.
So they're rioting already, Lizanne thought, her own mindscape filling with unpleasant memories of Skorazin and the Northern March of the People's Freedom Army. She was careful to confine the images within her own mind for fear of distressing Sophia.
If ever there was a poor time to start a revolution. Miss Lethbridge?
Sophia inquired, perturbed by the lack of communication.
Tell them also that secrecy is no protection now, Lizanne added. They need to publicize the complete and unvarnished story of what happened in Aratzia and Pharos. Only truth will unite us. Tell them that.
Blaska Sound.
Mathilda O'Canus pointed to a spot somewhere in the middle of the painted map. It stood 7 feet high and occupied much of the north-facing wall in the round tower that sprouted from the navigation's rooftop. The tower's eastern wall was dominated by a broad window facing out to sea, the room itself liberally equipped with optical devices of varying types and dimensions. Arshav occupied himself with peering through the lens of a huge telescope, whilst his mother conversed with Lizanne. The painting was a rendering of the entire Verestian region, though the style was illustrative, rather than strictly cartographical. Mountain ranges and forests were depicted in elevated perspective, rather than the usual lines and text. Lizanne was also grimly amused to see that the artist had chosen to populate the red tides with several fancifully proportioned drakes. She stepped closer to the map, peering at the narrow coastal channel marked in elaborate Eutherian as Blaska Sound. The mouth of the sound stood perhaps 20 miles north of the Seven Walls and Iskemir.
Close enough for a secure supply route, Lizanne mused, and also an easy place in which to bottle us up should they see the need.
What facilities are there? She asked, drawing a faint snicker from Arshav, who, she noticed, still had the smoker slung over his shoulder.
There's a coal mine 10 miles in on the northern bank of the sound,
Mathilda told her.
Raker's Mount, they call it. It's an old Corventine penal colony, abandoned since the Verestian liberation. Our people have never been fond of grubbing in the dirt. The seams are still viable, so I'm told, so fuel won't be a problem.
It's also a desolate shithole, Arshav added, grinning as he raised his eye from the telescope. No roads or railways and tall mountains all around. The only way in and out is by sea.
We'll need other materials, Lizanne said. Iron and steel, copper too. Also chemical agents for munitions, not to mention food.
Mathilda looked at her son, who shrugged, apparently bored with logistical details.
There'll be stocks in the Iskemir warehouses, he said. All sorts of cargoes piled up recently since trade's been so poor.
Make a list before you leave,
Athilda said, and handed Lazanne an envelope.
Our formal counter-proposal.
Seeing that the envelope had no seal, Lazanne extracted the papers within, reading over the first few paragraphs.
This is a company charter, she said, frowning.
Indeed,
Athilda said.
This day marks the founding of the Verestian Defense Conglomerate. I and Arshav are co-directors in chief. You'll note I've appointed you Director of Intelligence and Manufacturing Liaison.
Congratulations, Arshav put in.
The conglomerate will retain exclusive lifetime rights to any and all novel devices manufactured on conglomerate soil,
Lazanne read, feeling her pulse quicken.
Also, all salvage rights over any captured belligerent vessel, including its cargo, fixtures and fittings, plus any draconic plasma, hereafter referred to as product, harvested within the established borders of the Verestian region, will be regarded as conglomerate property.
Entirely fair in the circumstances, Arshav said, moving away from the telescope and holding up a pen. Wouldn't you agree? Lazanne stared at him, thinking it would be an easy matter to take that pen and push it through his eye and into his brain.
You'll get your share, Athilda said. As a director, you will be afforded 10% of total company stock. How you wish to distribute the dividends is up to you. Please add your signature to the final page.
She angled her head, looking past Lazanne at Takela with a fond smile.
Your delightful ward can witness the transaction.
Lazanne set her jaw and reached for the pen.
There is one other matter,
Athilda said, her son giving a pout of mock apology as he drew the pen out of reach.
My late husband's granddaughter.
What of her?
You indicated a detailed knowledge of what transpired at the Hive. I wish to know how. I am an exceptional initiatives agent. Intelligence is my business. Then be so kind as to share what intelligence you hold regarding the whereabouts of Akina Okanus. This is not a matter for negotiation.
Seeing the hard glint in the woman's eyes, Lazanne knew this was no bluff. She also knew it wouldn't profit her to share too much with these people. She abruptly decided to avoid any mention of Clay's mission to Crystalline Lake, despite what insights these two might offer regarding the explorations undertaken by Zenida's late father. An adage from Burgrave Artonin's translation of Selvurin folktales popped into her head as she took in the poorly concealed greed on the Arshav's faces.
Feed a snake, and your only thanks will be venom.
Captain Trumaine's flagship is the viable opportunity, Lazanne said. A vessel I believe you are familiar with. I learned the story from the crew.
Arshav took a step forward, gaze narrowing.
Is my niece aboard?
He demanded in a low, dangerous voice.
Do you have her?
She's no longer on the ship,
Lazanne went on, in a clipped, uncolored tone, the voice her tutors had drilled into her as the most effective when lying.
Poor liars always attempt a performance, she had been told. The truth requires no theatrics. The viable opportunity sailed eastward around Aratzia after departing the Hive, eventually putting in at Lossamark, where Zenida Okanus contrived to escape with her daughter.
That's a pile of dog shit, Arshav growled.
Captain Trumaine was wounded at the Battle of the Strait,
Lazanne continued, ignoring him and addressing his mother.
Leaving him in a comatose state. Command of the Viable then fell to Lieutenant Heilmore, with whom I believe you are also familiar. Heilmore freed Zenida Okanus from protectorate custody and employed her as the ship's blood-blessed, a measure that earned Captain Trumaine's severe disapproval when he woke from his coma in Lossamark Harbor.
It was the captain's intention to return Zenita Okanis to the brig for eventual trial and likely execution. It appears Lieutenant Heilmore found such a course of action unacceptable to his honor, and so he contrived to desert the ship along with Zenita, her daughter, and a small number of mutineers. It seems they seized a Corventine warship that had taken refuge in the harbor and sailed away, destination as yet unknown.
Arshav glowered and turned away, he and Athilda retreating to a corner of the room for a whispered discussion. They spoke in Verestian, which Lizanne knew well, but using a pirate slang that made translation difficult. She did, however, hear Athilda utter the phrases, "coming here," and "determined to kill us when she does," to which Arshav replied, "I do hope so, mother." Eventually, they seemed to reach some form of agreement and turned back to Lizanne, Arshav tossing her the pen. "Rest assured, Miss Blood," he cautioned her as she scrawled her name on the document. "We regard formal agreements just as seriously as does the corporate world, except in Verestia. Breach of contract is usually a fatal matter." He gave a bland smile and patted the stock of the smoker. "Don't mind if I keep this, do you?"
"Not at all," Lizanne said, handing the contract back to Athilda. "It's customary to mark a new partnership with gifts, after all."
"Partnership?"
Athilda's mouth twitched a little in suppressed amusement.
"What quaint notions you have, miss."
Her lips broadened into a smile as she extended the contract and pen to Takela.
"Come, my dear. Your very dainty hand is needed."
Chapter 14. Cirrus.
"Verestia," Moradin said, a sneer curling his broad lips as his gaze tracked over the pencil line Cirrus had sketched on the map.
The Marshal's thoughts went on to form the old Eutherian term for the region, one born of the many wars the Empire had fought there. The Sewer of Malcontents.
"A formidable target, then?"
Catelyn asked, her red and black eyes shifting between Cirrus and Moradin. The principal captains of the White's army were clustered around the navigation table, on the bridge of a large freighter recently renamed the Malign Influence, the new flagship of their fleet. Following behind were over 60 ships of varying sizes, together with numerous towed barges laden with spoiled. In all, the army now totaled some 60,000 formerly human souls, but, from the grudging concern leaking from Moradin's thoughts, it might well prove insufficient for the task ahead. "The Corventine Empire was never able to fully control the region," Cirrus said. "Even after it had been officially conquered, rebellions were frequent and the attrition of Imperial forces constant. When the previous revolution broke out, the Empire was obliged to withdraw its forces to reinforce the northern provinces. Following the revolution, repeated attempts to reconquer Verestia met with disaster." Cirrus's gaze flicked to Moradin. "Including one led by you, I believe, Marshal."
"Fuck you, boy,"
Moradin spat. Cirrus didn't bother to conceal his satisfaction at the Marshal's blossoming rage.
"And fuck your mother," Moradin went on. "I was second in command of that expedition, as you well know. And we'd have won if that fool admiral had listened to me. Be quiet."
Moradin's teeth clacked as his mouth slammed shut in response to Kathleen's thought command. He stood with nostrils flaring and eyes blazing as Kathleen turned back to Cirrus.
"You were saying, General?"
"The Verestians' success in defeating the Empire was largely due to their command of the sea," Cirrus went on, "and a willingness to put aside long-standing clan rivalries to pursue a common aim. Their society is famed for its supposed brutality, but is in fact remarkably stable and cohesive, due in part to a strictly observed code of ethics and the practice of resolving irreconcilable disputes through duels rather than large-scale conflict.
The geography of the region also presents numerous challenges. So many islands offer numerous refuges for enemy vessels and many opportunities for ambush. Then there is the question of numbers. Cirrus fell silent, turning to Veil Mist in expectation.
The iron ship records seized at Pharos.
The islander began in her unhesitant, precise Mandalorian.
Contain a demographic analysis of the Verestian region. It was compiled 5 years ago, when the Syndicate was considering seeking a formal arrangement with the Verestian Ruling Council regarding trading concessions. It concluded the region is home to approximately 30 million people. This is based on the availability of arable land and consumption of imported foodstuffs, a more reliable method than the Corventine census, which is notoriously inaccurate. This means that in the event of a large-scale conflict, the region could muster close to 4 million recruits of military age, including both men and women.
Kathleen arched an elegant eyebrow at Veil Mist.
4 million? That does seem rather a lot. This is the figure they could amass under ideal conditions,
Veil Mist replied.
The true figure, given the challenges of local terrain, factional conflicts, and logistical difficulties, will be much lower. Perhaps as low as 1 million, and even then that would require several months of organization. Let's say we give them...
Kathleen pursed her lips in consideration.
Just 1 month. How many are we likely to face then? Given the armed citizenry already on hand, local militias and likely rate of recruitment, between 200 to 250,000.
Forrest Spear spoke up, which was a rarity in these meetings, as he tended to make any contributions mentally. However, since Kathleen's ascension, Cirrus had noticed an increased tendency amongst the spoiled to communicate verbally. He assumed she just liked it that way.
We faced more in the islands,
Forrest Spear said in his guttural but still comprehensible Varsal. For some as yet unexplained reason, the tribals seemed to prefer the Corventine common tongue when speaking aloud. Not that it mattered. All languages were equally understood in this army.
Warriors born and bred for battle,
Forrest Spear added.
And still they fell before us.
But they didn't all possess firearms, Cirrus pointed out. Neither did they possess a large fleet of armed ships crewed by the best sailors in the world. He turned to Kathleen, compelled by her desire for unalloyed truth. We don't have the numbers for a successful conquest, or the ships. Moradin gave a pained grunt, drawing Kathleen's gaze. She smiled and unlocked his mouth.
Something to add, Marshal?
The southern coastal ports of the Empire, he said,
stubby finger jabbing at a series of successive points on the map.
Each one separated by at least 50 miles, unable to come to the other's aid should they be attacked.
Population?
Kathleen asked, turning to Veil Mist.
5 million all told,
she said, after a pause of only a few seconds.
But dispersed. Melkorin, the most westerly port, has a population of only 85,000. Even allowing for the vagaries of the Corventine census, it would seem a manageable objective. I estimate the recruitment yield to be close to 20,000 spoiled, allowing for a 3-4% casualty rate amongst our own forces. And when we're done there,
Kathleen said, a note of approval in her voice, as she traced her crimson fingernail along the coast.
We'll have yet more fruit to pluck. Excellent reasoning, my dear. You are as clever as you are beautiful.
Cirrus managed to summon enough fear to mask his disgust at the warm gratification these words provoked in Veil Mist's mind. Even the spoiled, it seemed, were not immune to the flattery of a beautiful madwoman.
Any additional concerns, General?
She asked, a gaze swiveling to Cirrus as she sensed his fear. He shook his head. Only an observation that battle is always uncertain, he said. She laughed, moving closer to pat his arm, a hand lingering to caress taut muscle beneath his sleeve.
But that's what makes it so stimulating.
Kathleen stepped back, closing her eyes momentarily as she communed with the white, which had chosen to perch itself on the wide aft deck of the malign influence, along with its clutch of juveniles. After a moment, she opened her eyes and favored them all with one of her brightest smiles.
Consent is given. Please plot a course to Melkorin. Are you angry with me?
Kathleen asked as they dined together. The malign influence lay at anchor a mile south of Melkorin, and Cirrus could see the flames rising above the harbor wall.
For keeping you from all the fun,
she added, sipping her wine. They had dined on sea trout, expertly poached by a former head chef from one of Moorsvale's more exclusive restaurants. Upon finding the fellow amongst the ranks of spoiled, Kathleen had immediately appointed him as her personal cook and dined every day on lavish meals of the highest quality. She always ate dinner on the observation deck to the rear of the bridge, seated at a table complete with an ornate silver candelabra, plates of antique Dalcian porcelain, and silver cutlery. It was a week since the conference, sufficient time to plan their attack and complete the approach. At Kathleen's instruction, the entire affair had been left in Moradin's hands. Cirrus found his own role restricted to overseeing the running of the fleet. He suspected she either wanted to stoke the rivalry between them, or obtain an unvarnished example of the Marshal's abilities, perhaps both. Moradin's plan had been characteristically straightforward, though he borrowed some of the more subtle elements from Cirrus's attack on Pharos. A small flotilla of ships, disguised as refugee vessels with besmirched hulls and unkept works, approached the port in late evening, their signal pennants displaying a request for safe harbor. The Melkorin authorities, however, had staunchly refused to raise the door in their wall, gathering their garrison and militia in and around the docks. Cirrus felt his sympathy for these people erode slightly when gun batteries on the wall began casting shells at the supposed refugees.
Yes, Kathleen agreed, sensing his disdain. Yet more souls deserving of their fate. But then, they all are.
Whilst the attention of the Melkorin defenders remained fixed on the ships outside their wall, the White's host of Reds swept over the coast to the east. They flew north for several miles, before turning west as the sun began to fade, swooping low to deposit spoiled and greens on the port's outlying suburbs. Meanwhile, Moradin led the bulk of the fleet to land the main force of spoiled infantry on a broad stretch of beach, 3 miles to the west. Within hours, the entire port was in chaos, and the Corventine troops and militia were unable to mount an organized defense. Resistance was still fierce, however, especially amongst the militia who were defending their homes and families. A few companies barricaded themselves into the more substantial buildings in the commercial district, holding out against repeated assaults until Moradin lost patience and asked for assistance from the Reds. Any action undertaken by the Drakes that lay outside the original plan had to be approved by Kathleen, their lives being regarded as so much more precious than the spoiled.
Are you sure, Marshal? Kathleen asked. Seems a trifle excessive to me. Can't you just wait for them to run out of ammunition?
They're blocking the main thoroughfare into the residential neighborhoods, Moradin replied. My scouts report a large number of people fleeing to the hill country to the north. The longer this lot holds out, the smaller our yield of recruits.
This had been enough for Kathleen to unleash the Reds, Katarius leading several dozen out of the night sky to blast the buildings with flame from top to bottom. This attack succeeded in eliminating resistance, but also birthed a conflagration that soon spread to much of the port's western districts.
What a marvelous strategist you are, Marshal, Kathleen observed. I ask for recruits, and you give me charred corpses.
Moradin's response consisted of a sullen, reluctant pulse of apology, which provoked a surprising laugh from Kathleen.
What a simply dreadful man, she commented to Cirrus. but useful. Not as useful as you, dear General, but still worth keeping around. Don't you think?
Cirrus sensed a genuine inquiry in her tone. Eyebrows raised above her wine glass as she added,
I'll kill him if you like.
He felt Moradin tense, the spoiled of his personal guard immediately turning towards the marshal with leveled rifles. Cirrus let the fear seep into his mind, masking his thoughts. Moradin was useful to the White, it was true. He was also supremely arrogant and self-interested, to the point of mania. Not to mention an imperial butcher with the blood of thousands on his hands. But, more than that, he hated his enslavement just as much as Cirrus did, and such hatred might suit his own ends in time. In land warfare he has no equal, Cirrus said, reaching for his own wine glass. He shrugged as he took a small sip. The wine was an expensive Mandalorian white of impressive vintage, part of the copious stocks looted from the iron ship stores in Pharos. Cirrus doubted even his father could have afforded a single bottle of the stuff. He had found since his conversion that his senses had been enhanced, including his taste buds, and he savored the tingle the wine left on his tongue. Notes of apple with a hint of lemon, matured in oak for at least 18 years. He shared the taste with Moradin, feeling the marshal's hatred swell along with his terror. However, Cirrus went on, lowering his glass, his instinctive aggression can cause problems, as you've seen. Perhaps punishment would be preferable to execution. But of course, I leave the matter in your hands.
Do you seek to teach me restraint?
Catherine's lips pursed in mock offense.
I should hope not, sir. I was never one for moderation. But you speak sense. Punishment it is.
Cirrus flinched as she blinked and sent a pulse of pure agony into Moradin's brain. The marshal stiffened and collapsed, writhing on the cobbled street as the port burned around him. Catherine held out her glass to the spoiled waiter nearby, who dutifully filled it. She had drained the glass by the time the pain faded from Moradin's mind.
I trust such lessons will not be necessary in future, she told him, all humor gone, and her thoughts chilly with sincerity. Now be about your business. 20,000 recruits is what I was promised, and what I expect.
Cirrus felt the marshal's thought command spread to the rest of the army, carrying strict injunctions against any unnecessary killing.
Apart from the children, of course. He added. They're of no use.
Ah,
Kathleen said, brightening as a second waiter approached bearing a tray.
Dessert. This is the point in the evening when most men would try to fuck me.
She had him stroll with her after dinner. Cirrus had been required to dress for the occasion, and wore the uniform of an iron ship protectorate colonel of infantry, complete with several medals won by its former owner. Catherine was attired in an elegant gown of black silk, embroidered with flames of red, the product of a skilled dressmaker captured and converted in Pharos. She also wore a shawl about her shoulders, fine lace threaded with jewels that glittered as they caught the flickering flames from Melkorin. Cirrus supposed that, but for the deformities and the dying city across the water, an ignorant observer might have thought them the image of a romantic young couple.
Oh, I beg your pardon, she added,
sensing his surprise at the coarseness of her language.
Seduce me.
Cirrus found himself at a complete loss for words. He had experienced a great deal in a short space of time, but some things were still far beyond his abilities.
Despite my reputation, I was quite choosy, you know,
Catherine went on.
Married men were always my preference, especially if their wives were one of those managerial bitches who loved to sneer at me so. I always found sex and revenge a potent mix.
They came to the prow of the ship, where she paused, rearranging her shawl to reveal her shoulders. Cirrus found himself momentarily distracted by the way the light of the burning city played over her flesh, smooth, unscaled, and wonderfully human.
"Why, thank you, sir,"
Gafflin said, sensing his involuntary lust.
"I was beginning to think such things beneath you."
She turned back to the city as a large explosion blossomed above the wall. From the scale of the blast, Cirrus assumed the fire had reached the garrison's arsenal.
"I had them burn Pharos before we left,"
Gafflin continued, the explosion fading into a cascade of debris.
"He hates cities, you see? The very notion of human civilization is offensive to him. I expect this is a sight to which we'll become quite accustomed before we're done."
"What happens then?" Cirrus asked. He was aware this might be dangerous. The spoiled did not question their great white god after all. But he colored his mind with what he hoped was a sufficient level of simple curiosity to conceal any sense of concern for the fate of the human world.
"The world will be his, and we will be his grateful servants,"
Gafflin replied, apparently failing to detect any artifice.
"For he has blessed us, has he not? The ability to seamlessly share thoughts and experience. Think of a whole world where lies have been banished, where every mind is united in a common purpose. This will be the last war in human history. I have a yen to be a mother when this is all over. My child will be heir to a new world of eternal peace."
She glanced over her perfect shoulder at him.
"You fathered a child, did you not?"
Katria's face when he shot her.
"Can we not love too?"
He drowned the memories in a deluge of fear and grief, but not before Kathleen sensed his guilt.
"We can't keep them all alive, General,"
she said, a frown of sincere sympathy creasing her brow.
"More's the pity. I'm sorry for your woman and the child, but soldiers die in war. Come the morning, we'll have thousands of freshly converted young women in our ranks. Choose one if you wish."
"No, thank you." Kathleen's sympathy turned to amusement, and she moved to him, reaching out to take his hand, perfect, unblemished fingers tracing over the calloused, scaled flesh.
"Still carrying a torch for your fallen lover?" she asked. "Or do I flatter myself that you worry over making me jealous?"
"Nothing," he thought, his mind sliding over hers like a hand pushing at smooth, cold glass. No clue as to her true intentions, what she really is.
"What I am?"
she asked with a laugh, provoking the shocked realization that he had failed to shield his thoughts.
"Oh, don't fret,"
she added, squeezing his hand as the fear flooded in. "It's refreshing to find a genuinely curious mind among this lot." She moved closer, her perfume rendered near intoxicating by his enhanced senses.
"I am the final word in his blessing of this world,"
she murmured, lips close to his.
"He needed me, you see? Not all of me, since he got a good deal from the other bitch before she died. But great as his mind is, it lacks..."
She let out an involuntary shout, a breath hot on Cirrus's face as she convulsed and collapsed at his feet. Cirrus started to crouch at her side, but froze as another far more powerful will invaded his mind. A low, rattling growl came from above, and Cirrus looked up to find the white's huge head poised above them, thin tendrils of smoke leaking from both nostrils. Its gaze flicked over Cirrus before locking onto Kathleen. She let out a strangled scream, jerking on the deck as spittle drooled from her lips.
"Punishment," Cirrus thought.
A series of thuds drew his gaze to the surrounding deck, and he saw the juvenile whites had come to watch the spectacle, wings flapping in excitement, tails and necks coiling as they hissed and squawked. Cirrus found he had no need to draw on his reserves of fear to mask his thoughts. The fist of terror that gripped him now was completely authentic, though he did find room amongst it all for a singular insight. "Your God does not love you back," he decided, as Catherine's choking shudders subsided into a gibbering tremble. The white's growl trailed off, and it grunted out a gust of smoke before launching itself into the air, the wind generated by its wings strong enough to force Cirrus to his knees. He watched it ascend into the night air, ivory scales painted pink by the light of the burning city. It leveled out and angled its massive body towards Melkorin, its juvenile brood clustering around it, screaming in excited hunger. It had been the same after Theros. After the fall came the feast, and there were many children in this city. He lowered his gaze to Catherine, seeing that her tremors had stopped, and she now lay in an exhausted stupor. He also saw that she had contrived to besmirch her silk gown with a copious amount of urine. He wondered if the white would care if he killed her now. Cirrus crouched and gathered Catherine into his arms, lifting her easily. He stood watching the white dive down into the burning city, its dreadful brood following close behind, before lowering his gaze to the dark waters below. "Throw the mad bitch over the side. The world will thank you for it." Catherine let out a soft, fearful whimper, her fluttering eyelids telling of a mind beset by nightmares. She shifted in his arms, moving her head closer to his chest in an instinctive quest for comfort. Cirrus turned and carried her towards the nearest hatch, making for her cabin, and sending a command to the crew to bring her some clean clothes. Chapter 15. Lizanne.
"I didn't like the way that woman looked at me."
Lizanne glanced up at Tekayla from the contract that cemented her employment in the Verestian Defense Conglomerate. She had read it several times during the return journey, finding to her annoyance that Ithilda Okanis had crafted something it would be very hard to extricate herself from later, at least legally.
"You shouldn't,"
she muttered in agreement, before glancing out the window. They had left Iskamir behind a day ago, and were nearing the southern extremity of the Sybaris Archipelago, beyond which lay the hopefully secure anchorage of Veman's Island.
"I won't have to see her again, will I?"
Tekayla asked.
"Or that son of hers. He was almost as horrid."
Lizanne began to snap at her, irritation at the cleverness of the Okanis clan, leading her to scold this girl for her weakness.
"An entire world of horrid people awaits you," she had been about to say. "Harden your sensibilities and keep a loaded revolver handy."
Instead, she took a breath and recalled all the many trials Tekayla had endured, concluding she was already as hardened as Lizanne wished her to be. So she said,
"I'm sorry. I'll do my best to ensure you don't find yourself in their company again."
They had resisted lighting the blood burner for the return trip, Lizanne deciding the burst of speed would be best saved for emergencies. The flight was therefore long and somewhat tedious, passed in resentful scrutiny of the contract she had been obliged to sign, interspersed with fitful dozing. Her sleep had been interrupted several times by the buffeting the aerostat received from the winds at this more southerly latitude. Hours of fighting to keep the machine on course left Tekayla increasingly fatigued as the journey wore on. Lizanne wanted to take over for a time, but lacked the required familiarity with the controls. Besides which, maneuvering herself into the pilot's seat in the cramped confines of the gondola seemed next to impossible.
"When we're back on the ship,"
she told Tekayla, as the first of the outlying Sybaris Isles drifted by below,
"your first task will be teaching me how to fly this thing."
The fleet came into view some 2 hours later, the many ships clustered in a tight arc around the speck of rock Lizanne's map confirmed as Veman's Island. Daylight was fading fast, and Lizanne feared night would fall before they could settle onto the foredeck of the viable opportunity. Fortunately, Captain Trumaine evidently saw the danger and ordered all lights lit, including the frigate's powerful searchlight, which was lowered to illuminate the front of the ship. Tekayla was obliged to navigate a stiff crosswind to complete the approach, her hands dancing from lever to lever, as she gave voice to some choice curses in Varsal, Lizanne would never have suspected her of knowing.